VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Our special guest on this edition of the program is General Michael V. Hayden, retired U.S. Air Force four-star general and former director of the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency. He is the only individual in U.S. history to hold the highest position of leadership in both agencies. General Hayden is currently a distinguished visiting professor at George Mason University in Virginia and a principal at the Chertoff Group. That's a security consultancy founded by former Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff. General Hayden is also the author of the recently published book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. It is a memoir and reflective analysis of his time at the National Security Agency and the strategies employed by American intelligence operatives in what General Hayden refers to as an age of terror. He tackles the central question that bedevils people living in a democracy in an age of electronic communications, balancing the need for privacy and liberty against the imperative of national security. We'll talk with General Hayden about this delicate balance, the challenges of gathering intelligence, thwarting potential terrorist attacks, and countering the terrorist narrative in open societies. We'll also explore his views about the significance and implications of the recent terror attack in the heart of Brussels, for which the so-called Islamic State group claimed responsibility. General Hayden, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks, Carol. Jeff, good to see you.
Well, General Hayden, before we talk about the book, by way of getting into the themes of your book, we'd like to get your take on the coordinated terror attacks in Belgium. Certainly, they're a vivid illustration of the threats facing Europe, the continued growth of radical extremism, foreign fighters returning from Syria, Belgium's fractured and some say weak intelligence and police forces, the marginalized communities of Muslims, particularly in Molenbeek. What are your
thoughts? The first impression, all right, is that this was sadly expected, almost inevitable. And I realize that's a pretty dramatic word, but when you look what has happened, the target country, part of an arc that we could see, the target itself in terms of the soft targets, the transportation targets, the maximum civilian casualties, something we could see. The level of sophistication, kind of continuing on that same arc we've seen ISIS as it, so to speak, ups its game. And I think the only thing that changed the arc that we all saw coming was perhaps the tempo, which was probably sped up by the arrest of one of the terrorists last week. And my sense was they feared what he would tell the police, and so this was a use-it-or-lose-it kind of situation with regard to the plot. But again, the great sadness is this is not surprising, and then suggests it's certainly not the last either.
General, given that it's probably not the last attack, what does the way this attack was carried out say about how deeply rooted Islamic State is in Europe, in Belgium specifically, but across the continent?
Yeah, this was a product of a network. All right, this is beyond the capacity of a so-called lone wolf or even a small self-radicalized group. Number one, you can see continuity between it and the Paris attacks in terms of style, even, I believe we're going to find out, in terms of the explosives that were used. So what you saw here was the product of an infrastructure that continues to exist, was not destroyed in the suicide act itself. And so what it says is that our enemy has a network that seems to be active and thriving in the heart of Europe. And now back to your question, Carol, about Islamic communities and a sense of alienation and so on. It appears, particularly in Belgium, but we've seen it in France and even in Great Britain and elsewhere, there is a part of the Muslim community that does not feel well connected with the broader society. Otherwise, how does the fugitive live for 4 months in the heart of a European capital? Clearly, he had some at least latent support from the community in which he took refuge.
Of course, there's a lot of criticism about lack of proper intelligence sharing, the weak link which Brussels seems to, or Belgium seems to, represent in Europe with respect to policing. But back to these marginalized communities, General, What more should be done, in your view, to reduce these breeding grounds, particularly in Belgium?
Well, let me say something that might not sit nicely with all of your viewers abroad. We need to be more like America. Now, let me quickly qualify that. We have our faults, all right? One of them is not our inability to assimilate foreign populations. Mm-hmm. We're actually quite good at that. And so we don't have the kinds of circumstances that you see in Molenbeek, that you see in some of the industrial zones around the French capital, even you might see in some of the industrialized cities of Great Britain. We do assimilate. A cocktail party fact that I occasionally throw out: the average Islamic income in the United States is above the national average. We're good at this, and that's just not something that's good for our democracy. It's good for our security. It actually makes us a safer society than many of our friends in Western Europe are.
General, one of the things that comes up in the book, but you write about before 9/11, the terrorist attacks, and then what had to be done afterwards. And afterwards, we've seen a tremendous effort by the U.S. intelligence community to get on the same page so that information is shared, so that dots can be connected. And that's been something that's been an ongoing effort in Europe. How much further does Europe have to go before it gets to the point where different countries are able to help each other out more?
So that's another strength in terms of not just we're assimilating society, we're accustomed to bringing immigrants in and they get to become Americans very quickly. We're also pretty good at that espionage security thing, too. We actually have very good, very powerful, very well-resourced security agencies, which none of our European friends can match. We've gotten our game to the next level in terms of information sharing. And this is just an observation, not a criticism. Not many of our European friends have their game at the level we have it at when it comes to sharing information. And that applies for some of them internally, and it really applies to them externally. Actually, very often we find our partners, not just in Europe, but globally, far more willing to share information with the Americans than they are willing to share information with their neighbors. It's just a fact. It works that way. Now, there's an additional complication, all right? And I don't want to turn this into a political science discussion, but governance in Europe has been divided between the community and the remaining national governments. The community has taken on an awful lot of things that used to be the province of the sovereigns. Some of the things the community has taken over, questions of commerce, questions of currency for some, and questions of privacy. And yet security remains a national responsibility. So what you have in Brussels, and here by Brussels I mean the European Union institutions there, what you have in Brussels are people making these tough trade-offs you suggested earlier, liberty, security, safety, privacy, making these tough trade-offs at the union level with no responsibility for providing security. And you have people at the national level with this intense responsibility to provide for security, who now have to accommodate themselves to privacy as defined by the European Union. Believe me, it creates great stress between ourselves and Europe. And now I predict it's going to create great stress within Europe as these various nations begin to realize that they may have to recalibrate this necessary balance between their citizens' privacy and their right to life.
One of the things that strikes me is how just a few weeks ago, the French Interior Minister was touring the U.S. and he spoke at George Washington University, and he spoke about the need for better surveillance and the need to accommodate some of the privacy laws so that French internal security, for example, could track people much more effectively than they do now. And that's a debate that's been going on in Europe, but also here in the United States. Given the impact that the attacks on Brussels seem to be having, given how so many people saw Paris and the attacks there as a wake-up call, do you see any shift in how governments and how populations are willing to accept decisions by various Western governments to move where the lines are in terms of getting intelligence as opposed to respecting privacy?
Yeah, they will. And we're going to recalibrate. And that's not all entirely good news, Jeff. These are decisions best made at times other than when everyone is frightened. And that's why we've probably lost an opportunity over the last couple of years, post-Snowden revelations and so on. Now, I'm speaking from my heart. I reflect it in the book. I think Snowden may have accelerated a necessary conversation, but he also badly distorted it. And an awful lot of decisions were made based upon what I view to be just inaccuracies. And so now you've got a frightened population that's probably going to want to do a do-over with regard to some of those decisions, or at least some of those attitudes, and they're going to do it while they're frightened. These things are best done in the calm light of day by rational people attempting to balance things, all of which are virtues: security, privacy, liberty, safety. And there are no villains in this play. It permeates the book. This is all a field of gray. There is no pure white high ground and no pure black low ground in this story. It's all about trade-offs that free peoples have to make. And I wish we would have had the adult conversation internally and with our European friends in a more calm time, but we're going to go have it now, and that's a necessary thing.
You say that part of the conversation has been colored by misunderstandings. Yeah. What is the biggest misunderstanding that's hindered the conversation that the public and the intelligence community and governments have been having?
Yeah, the biggest misunderstanding is that the security services of Western democracies are some malevolent actor within those democracies themselves, that somehow the people who populate those security agencies don't share the values of the broader society, which again is a theme that I use to permeate the book. You know, these are not alien beings behind the green door. They go to the same schools, same universities, share the same values. So that's a misunderstanding. A second one, and more technical, is that when any story is written about particularly electronic surveillance, given everyone's legitimate nervousness about their own privacy, the story, and the phrase I use in the book, Carol, the story just gets rushed to the darkest corner of the room. And so some writers take the fact that a security service like NSA or GCHQ or DGSE or CISMI in Italy, take the fact that a security service may have access to 1.5 billion whatever, fill in the blank, that they're actually collecting and reading 1.5 billion whatever. And of course, that's not even desirable. That actually gets in the way of doing your espionage job. And so you're out there, Jeff, with these great fears, which anyone who's actually done this understand are not based in fact. Now, I need to be very careful here, all right? It is a legitimate fear to be concerned about what it is your government does or does not know about you, what your government can or cannot learn about you. In the American experience, NSA's got trillions of phone records based upon the 215, the metadata program. I think that's fine. NSA has scrupulously used those only for the purposes for which they originally gathered them from American telecom providers. That said, I totally understand an American with a legitimate view rooted deeply in our history saying, I know you're not misusing it, Hayden. I just don't want any government to have that much information that could be misused. That's a fair discussion. But unfortunately, the discussion here, and I think the discussion between ourselves and the Europeans, wasn't that one. It was that we were already misusing it, and therefore this had to be stopped.
Before we go to a break, General Hayden, talk about the significance of your book title, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror, where you really discuss this tension.
So the short version, Carol, is we don't get to create the edge. The American political process, the French political process, the Nigerian political process gets to create the edge. That is a product of democratic governments and democratic peoples. But once I get that edge, once someone has created that box for me, if the circumstances demand it, I've got to use the whole box. I've got to play to the edge, knowing full well that in the American system, I know that's going to lead to some very unpleasant op-eds sooner or later, that I'm going to be hauled in front of some congressional committee for some unpleasant hearings. But if I play back from the edge, I may be protecting me. I may be even protecting my agency, but I'm not protecting you. And that's what my responsibility is. So we play to the edge.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is General Michael V. Hayden, retired four-star Air Force general and former director of the CIA and the NSA. We're discussing themes in his new book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to one of our fans, Mohsin Riaz. He's from Islamabad, Pakistan. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Well, back to you, General Hayden. I'd like to ask you about another relatively controversial but now rather common tool for fighting terrorism. As head of the CIA from 2006 to 2009, you had to approve drone strikes. So let's talk about drone warfare. There's a movie called Eye in the Sky now that illustrates the costs and the benefits of using drones, certainly to the extent that it lessens the U.S. footprint. Arguments for targeted killings of terrorists who can wreak havoc can, of course, should be made. President Obama continues to use drones, building upon the legacy of George W. Bush, for whom you served. Do you think the United States has the right formula for the use of drones and rules that govern drone warfare? Do you think that the benefits do outweigh the risks and the costs?
Well, the answer is obvious. Yes. All right. And I lay out the arguments in the book. But I understand it's a difficult question. And frankly, I think the book is fairly candid in this regard. I did an excerpt of the book for the New York Times, and it's about 3,000 words. And I lifted it from the chapter on targeted killings. And the Times wrote the headline. You never get to write the headline in these sorts of things. And the Times wrote the headline, Targeted Killings, Necessary, Precise, and Imperfect. Mm-hmm. Carol, I could have kissed him. I could not have thought of a better headline to capture what it was I was trying to say. So the United States has conducted targeted killings outside of internationally agreed theaters of conflict. I get it. It's a fairly unique American legal interpretation that says that we get to do that under the laws of armed conflict. Not many other nations agree with that. As you can probably tell, I'm very comfortable with it. All that said, even when we were doing this, and even when we believed we were compelled to do it out of playing to the edge, out of our responsibility to keep this republic safe, even when we were doing it, we had to take what we call a terrorist off the battlefield. We always knew there were second, third, and fourth order effects. There were bills that were going to have to be paid, even if we knew we had to go ahead and do the first thing, which was, again, make the country safer. Bills to be paid in terms of maybe filling out the jihadist recruiting narrative. Bills to be paid in what, even in the best of circumstances, is unavoidable collateral damage. Bills to be paid in arguments with even our good friends who disagreed with our legal theory. We knew that. But we also knew that the first order effect was so essential that we had to go do it. I was having this discussion with Richard Haass, the head of the Council on Foreign Relations. And Richard actually summarized it better than I could, talking about targeted killings and drone strikes. Richard said, you know, what you need here is not a switch. What you need here is a dial. In other words, this is a useful tool. I don't want to give it up. But if you decide to use it, you've got to dial it up and dial it back based on a total appreciation for all the effects that you are creating.
General, one of the criticisms from some analysts of the targeted drone strikes is that regardless of the problems with the second, third order effects, is that oftentimes some of the evidence suggests they don't work. How do you respond to that with the fact that so many leaders have been taken off the battlefield? There have been strikes against al-Shabaab, Islamic State, al-Qaeda, yet these groups persist and in some cases seem to be making a comeback.
Well, the readers of the book don't have to believe me. Why don't you believe al-Qaeda? I was actually the beneficiary of about a dozen letters from the hall of documents out of Abbottabad that were made public by the American government in a court case in New York. And these are letters between bin Laden and his senior lieutenant. And they drip with the agony that the targeted killing program is imposing on al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda's senior leadership. There is not a word in there about, and the Americans are killing the innocents. No, no. This is all about the effect we are having on their operation. And again, it's almost dripping with despair. And so this has been a useful tool. But if you talk to people like me, I have, all right, they will all sign up to this reality. As necessary as this is, as successful as this has been, we cannot kill our way out of this problem. All this program can do is to buy our political leadership space and time. And if we don't take advantage of that space and time, let me give you the sad conclusion. People like me get to kill people forever. And that's a very bad state of affairs.
Is there a concern with the program that groups are beginning to adapt that since it's been used so much and it's been relied upon so heavily, that there are ways now for terrorist groups like Islamic State, like al-Shabaab, to start getting around it, to plan around it, to plan for losing leaders. And so what is the next step then in the drone program?
No, look, all military advantage is transient. The only enemy who doesn't adapt is the one you've already killed. All right? And so it's a natural course of conflict. Now, it doesn't mean we throw this away. When we force them to respond to these attacks, if you read some of the letters I include in the book from al-Qaeda leadership, what'd they do? They dispersed. Well, what'd they do? They stopped planning and went into hiding. Okay, I can accept that as an effect. You're actually pushing their capacities down. But again, this is an intelligent, adaptive enemy. And so as successful as this has been, we've got to keep pace with what the enemy is doing to protect himself. Now, that might suggest, Carol, you already said one of the advantages, limited American footprint on the ground. Well, if this enemy adapts so well to this, it might mean we have to put more Americans into harm's way if we want to create the same effects that we've been able so far to create with unmanned vehicles.
General Hayden, I have a question that pertains to factors that have helped to exacerbate the growth of the Islamic State, which we are trying to combat, as the Europeans are as well. And this regards Syria, the Syrian conflict. Now, Syria was an issue when you served under former President George W. Bush. You even quote in your book that then National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley spoke of so-called flipping Assad to peel Damascus away from its alliance with Iran. Fast forward to the democratic uprisings in 2011 that have now morphed into a deadly civil war. Some critics of the Obama administration say that had America and its allies acted more forcefully early on to stop Assad from violently turning on his own people, the uprising would not have morphed into this full-fledged war. No one was calling for troops on the ground. It was sort of a case of convergence between our values of freedom and democracy and strategic interests.
Right.
But as we know, in 2012, President Obama issued the advice of then-Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, even CIA Chief David Petraeus, all of whom argued for more defensive weaponry, training for the Free Syria Army. Then there was the famous so-called non-strike incident in 2013 after President Obama said that, well, there was a red line due to Assad's use of chemical weapons, but he did not strike the Syrian Air Force and rather struck a deal with Moscow to destroy Assad's chemical weapons, even though Assad went on to use chlorine gas, barrel bombing his own people. Question. In hindsight, how much of a factor do you think inaction by the West, and the U.S. in particular, early on, you know, may have paved the way for the rise of ISIS in Syria, perhaps strengthened the hand of Assad, led the way for what we see now, the intervention of Moscow on the side of Assad in Iran, spawning the refugee crisis?
Yeah, so first of all, I'm going to go critical here in a minute in terms of commentary. But let me begin with the comment you put out already, Carol. This was hard. It was always hard. There were never any easy decisions. Early on, this was about Democrats and autocrats. And I think the global instinct was, well, you got to go help the Democrats. Quickly, it became a sectarian conflict. It became the Alawites against the Sunnis. And the other minorities, the Druze, the Christians, the Kurds, they're back here. They're not playing. And so it quickly became Alawite against the Sunnis. I understand the reluctance of the United States, the American Armed Forces, and an American president to get involved in yet another sectarian conflict in the Middle East. I get that, all right? And so as you go through 11 and into 2012, you know, I can see the caution here. You know, we've been here, done that. It's hard to do. But by the time you just referred to, when you got Leon Panetta and Dave Petraeus and Bob Gates all saying, Mr. President, we got to go.
Thank you for the
clarification. We've got to play with a stronger hand. By that point, it was clear to me that as bad as the sectarian aspects of the conflict had become, that it was clear to me where this was heading, absent some sort of powerful external intervention. These things never break to the middle. They break to the extremes. And I think by 2012, it was very clear where this was heading. Let me tell you what I said in late 2012. I was giving a speech to a group here in Washington, and I said, given current American policy as a constant, so I was assuming we would not change course, I see only three outcomes for Syria, and the best one is that Assad wins. Now, that wasn't my calling for him to win, but absent the Americans getting involved, there are only three ways this was going to end up. ISIS wins. Whoa, that's bad. nobody wins, and you've got this charnel house here for as far as the eye can see in terms of horrific human suffering, which then leads me to believe that as bad as it was, without American intervention, the best outcome was Assad would win. And that's really bad, which then, I'm circling back to the foundation of my argument, we should have done something. We should have moved. And I know there was nervousness, but let me ask you a rhetorical question. What could we have done that in any way would have made this thing worse than it is today? And I don't have an answer for that.
Of course, that's what many people are saying. And as we said earlier, both Iraq and Syria, you know, the sectarian grievances on the part of Sunnis in particular, as long as somebody like Assad, who is backed by Iran, is in power, it's going to feed that.
Right.
So it's a vicious cycle.
It is. It is. And so you've got the Russians coming in, and you've got some Americans saying, well, maybe we should team with the Russians. But primarily, the Russians are there to buck up Assad. There are no exits. That's the reality. So I do not see a convergence of American and Russian interests here.
Right. And, of course, unless we tackle these various, you know, causes of what we're seeing today in Europe and with the terror attacks, we're not going to have a solution. I'd like to ask you, General, about the campaign 2016, because national security is, of course, at the forefront.
So it's time for entertainment for our international viewers?
Of course, you know, we see GOP candidates like Donald Trump. He's the front runner now. He's saying that he would like to use techniques surveilling Muslims, banning Muslims from the United States, temporarily, perhaps, but nonetheless, banning Muslims, speaking in favor of waterboarding, a form of torture that President Obama has condemned on the merits and because it doesn't seem to really work. I mean, do these statements about bringing back torture concern you and questioning the NATO alliance?
So this all came about the time I'm doing the book tour, right? And so I'm out there talking to fellow Americans about a book called Playing to the Edge. And the book is written as a kind of an explanation. It's not apologetic, but it's explaining why we played to the edge. And I thought the arguments, Carol, that I would have to make is to justify why it was okay to play to the edge. As it turns out, in most audiences, what I was trying to explain is that there are edges, that there are limits, because the campaign rhetoric seemed to have thrown the legal limits over the side. And so I actually spent a great deal of time saying, no, there are limits. There are reasons for limits. And to go beyond those limits, not only ethically wrong or politically embarrassing, they're operationally ineffective. And so the one that I really struck on was one of the candidates saying, and we should target terrorist families too. And I said on one national TV show that that just wasn't going to happen. That as soon as that order hit someone in an American military uniform, he or she would simply say, sir, that's just not going to happen. The enduring theme of the radical jihadist theology, motivation, is a theme of undying enmity between Islam and the West. That's not true, and we need to undercut that theme. But when you have American presidential candidates saying they all hate us, or saying none of them can get into this country, what you are doing is endorsing the narrative of our enemy, of undying enmity. And so I'm not telling you that might be a dangerous thing if one of these people gets to be president. I'm telling you that a presidential candidate saying that now actually makes us less safe today.
What impact does that have on the intelligence community as a whole, which is trying to monitor, is trying to figure out where the next threat is coming from? And what impact does it have on them, first morally, but then also how much more complicated does it make the job? Because it would seem like chatter would just explode.
So, number one, on a personal level, we work with a host of Islamic countries around the world, and I'm talking about in the security realm. And these are very good partners, and these are people we rely on. And so it would be a very sad thing if I would have to have spent the first 10 or 15 minutes of my valuable time, of his valuable time, explaining, pay no attention to what's going on over here. We still love you. We're still friends. So that's one. The second is that it does create this kind of buzz in the network, and you've got people responding to this. It is a genuine recruiting tool, but it also creates some noise on the network that makes it more difficult for people like, well, the people I left behind, the people I write about in the book, to actually discern the genuine threats to the United States.
General Michael Hayden is a retired four-star general. He's former director of the NSA and CIA and author of the new book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. Well, General Hayden, congratulations
on
your book.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. We greatly appreciate it. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. And joining me on the program was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.